I want to take a break from the podcast right now, and I want to give you a gift. And I want to do that to thank you for being a listener. I put my heart and soul into this podcast. I love interviewing today's experts, researchers, MDs, psychologists, sleep trainers, you name it. I hope you feel inspired to take care of yourselves and your families. And I just want to thank you for being a listener and hanging out with me. So the code PODCAST10 is going to give you a one-time $10 off code at kellylevesque.com, your next order of protein powder. You can either use that on my grass-fed beef isolate protein or on my new vegan chocho bean protein. Now, here's what I love about my protein powders. It's 3 ingredients or less. So we don't use fillers, emulsifiers, no fortified vitamins or minerals. It's easy to digest and naturally made without any enzymes or chemicals like hexane. So it's 3 ingredients. With my grass-fed beef isolate, that's 100% grass-fed beef, and it's made in the way that you would make bone broth. So just heat and water. And we dehydrate that end product to get that collagen-rich protein powder that your whole family can drink. It can be added to coffees, to smoothies, and you can get it in vanilla, chocolate, and unflavored. I want to point out that my vanilla and chocolate is made with organic vanilla bean, organic cacao, and the only sweetener used is organic monk fruit. We don't use any maltodextrin. Our monk fruit is 100% ground monk fruit, and it's organic. And with my vegan line, I'm so excited to have launched this and to have it out into the world. It's a regenerative bean from South America called the chocho bean. And the chocho bean is the most superior plant-based protein powder you can get your hands on, because not only is it a complete protein, but the process is made with heat and water only. They're crushed and soaked, and what that end product results in is an anti-nutrient-free protein powder. So you're not gonna have any lectins, phytates, or oxalates in your protein powder. Makes it super easy to digest, and it's really, really delicious and robust in cooking as well. So I love it if I want a thicker smoothie or a smoothie bowl. And I also love it in my baked goods, from my cookies to my muffins, pancakes, and breads. It's the perfect protein addition. So if you want to give either of these proteins a try, or you've already been purchasing these proteins and want to take advantage of this special deal, the code PODCAST10 is going to get you $10 off for being a listener here at the Be Well by Kelly podcast. So head to kellylevesque.com or bewellbykelly.com. Put the protein you'd like to purchase in your cart and use the code PODCAST10 for $10 off. Thank you, thank you, thank you for tuning in. Dr. Drew Ramsey is a psychiatrist, one of psychiatry's leading proponents of nutritional psychiatry, and the author of the new book, Eat to Beat Depression and Anxiety. He is an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons, and he founded the Brain Food Clinic in New York City, offering treatment and consultation for depression, anxiety, and emotional wellness concerns. The clinic incorporates evidence-based nutrition and integrative psychiatry treatments with psychotherapy, coaching, and responsible medication management. Using the latest in brain science, nutrition, and mental health research, and an array of delicious food, the clinic helps people improve their mental health and their mental fitness. So let's welcome Dr. Drew to the show. Dr. Drew, welcome to the show. I'm so excited that you're here. I had so much fun catching up with you before we started. I just feel like this is a really important topic, but just, I want to thank you for your time.
Kelly, thank you so much. I'm excited. You've been thinking about health and food for so long. So I'm really excited to share the conversation with you and everybody's tuning in. Thank you so much. I'm really excited to talk about all of the new science and the new ways that we understand that you can impact your mental health and your brain health with food.
Oh, it's your new book title just like grabs the reader. Eat to Beat Depression and Anxiety. And that's what you've been doing for 15 years is you've been working in nutritional psychiatry and helping people in a private practice that's now virtual, which is so awesome because people can get in touch with you and from anywhere. But I do want to unpack the science because I want people to understand the connection between food and mental health. Can you tell me how you got started in this career field and what is the science telling us?
Yeah, so sure. Let's go over that because I think that, you know, it's such a big promise. And I think particularly people who have depression and anxiety, you know, you've been sold so many false bills of goods, from like supplements to different treatments to just things that haven't helped. And so many people often like, oh, you know, have you tried this? Have you tried your diet? So I really am excited to share the new science and the reality of nutritional psychiatry. And so how I got into this, I'm a psychiatrist. I went to medical school at Indiana University, and then was really fortunate to train in adult psychiatry at Columbia University, where I've stayed on as a faculty member. And it's really been a wonderful place, really rigorous intellectual place that really forces you to value data, or pushes you to value data in a way that has really made the last 10 years satisfying, because there's been so much science coming out around particularly depression, but depression and anxiety, and moreover, how mental health is impacted by food. And so I started both in my personal life, I don't know, I was an athlete in college, I really cared about food. I grew up on a farm, so I've grown up a lot of food and eaten a lot of homegrown food. My parents were kind of some of those early, like organic, back to the land, kind of grow our food, homesteader, hippie types. And so then, you know, in medical training, I don't know, there wasn't, I mean, there's not a lot of talk about nutrition. I was a vegetarian, and this is like a long time ago. Like, I'm old. So this is like 1996, and I'm like a low fat vegetarian in medical school in Indiana. Right. It was like that. It wasn't a very healthy vegetarian diet, but I was very interested in, you know, how I ate and the way I lived my life. How could that support my vibrancy and my mental health? I'm a really, you know, a really active, I guess, creative person. Like, I'm at my happiest when I'm kind of bouncing around with people, usually outside doing something athletic and creative. And I found, you know, the rigors of college and medical school, you know, sort of challenged that. But I had this notion, wow, there's things that I could do. And back then, of course, there was all this talk about cholesterol and saturated fat. And so I was following those dietary principles. I then started training in psychiatry. A lot of science started coming out about things like omega-3 fats. And I didn't eat any fish. And it's just one of those things you're sitting there scratching your head and you're like, you know, the evidence, like in the science of those molecules, is darn cool. Like, if you're into brain health, it's hard not to eat fish. It's just like, wow, like that's original brain food. My friend, Brett Stecka, has this great book, The History of the Human Brain. And he talks about a lot of these nutrients and how brain evolution really revolves around like seafood. So anyway, I began to question, you know, is what I'm eating really feeding my mental health? And nobody's really thinking about that. We're not, you know, when we think food and psychiatry, think eating disorders, right? We never learn to take like a history around food. Maybe you ask people about like their hobbies and their diet and, you know, what do they do to keep themselves well? And patients, especially, you know, where I trained in New York, people say, oh, you know, I eat a pretty healthy diet. And I just noticed there was a lot more there. I started talking to patients about food a lot. My first book, The Happiness Diet, came out. I started really thinking, how do you apply this in clinical practice? How do I still be a good psychiatrist? You know, so you don't feel when you come and see me for like, I don't know, addiction or suicidal thoughts or bipolar disorder, I'm like, have you tried cauliflower rice? It's amazing. Have you tried keto? Right? You know, I'm still a psychiatrist, but we're not neglecting this foundational piece. Yes, that's a good question, Kelly. Like, how does food relate to mental health? So it's foundational. Your brain's made of food, right? All the different nutrients your brain needs, iron, zinc, you know, those should come and do come from your food. The metabolic health of your body, you know, I think, and really, I wouldn't separate your body from your brain. If people listening are doing that, you think of it as different, or your mental health and your physical health is different. Like, I think it's like a bad idea in 2021, because your gut is so important to your brain health in all kinds of ways we're understanding, and your dietary pattern is so important to it. So Kelly, there's so much data now. I mean, it's really expanded from those initial studies about omega-3 fats to looking at dietary pattern and how that affects depression risk. All these prospective correlational studies that show how we eat really does relate and is linked to depression risk, dementia risk, anxiety risk, ADHD risk. And then the real holy grail in medicine happened just a few years ago, where research groups started testing, giving specific dietary recommendations like we do in the brain food clinic to patients. And there wasn't any research really supporting what we were doing like this. These were randomized trials. Patients would get, you know, some type of supportive therapy, like a befriending group. And then the people in the intervention group would get like hardcore, like Mediterranean dietary counseling sessions with a nutritionist like yourself or with a group. And they just found really significant impact. And not just in mild depression, when you think like, oh, you're a little depressed, maybe you should eat like more fish. Not like that. Like, one of the trials, the Healthy Med trial, 86.3% of the patients were severely depressed. And I like, I like that trial because I think we all kind of have a set of biases about mental health. There's a bunch of them, right? That if you're really, really symptomatic, you know, you shouldn't get lifestyle interventions like exercise and nutrition, where like that's totally backwards. That's in some ways where it's most important because these are very empowering interventions if done right for patients. You know, that it's something that you can do, it's something that you own, and especially when supported, where it's not overwhelming, like, oh, of course you're depressed, you're eating like crap, like here's all this healthy food, now go. That doesn't work, right? Because patients who are in a mental health setting are always in a unique set of circumstances, facing significant challenges with mood, with anxiety, with organization, with structuring. So it's really a very specific setting that we feel really privileged to be working in, of helping people really dial in their diet based on a lot of this data and a lot of what we've been seeing clinically in terms of what helps folks.
I love that we're finally taking this information and these recommendations that you've been using in the Brain Clinic, and we're seeing them in these clinical trials. And as you mentioned, it's not mildly depressed. These are a significant chunk of these people were severely depressed. Can we talk about what the recommendations were for these patients in regards to the food changes that they were to make? And if they parallel your recommendations, can we jump into those too?
For sure. And first I want to say that a lot of these patients are in treatment. So a lot of our patients are taking medications or in psychotherapy, and a lot of these trials, the good ones, it's like that. We're trying to really see in real world with real patients in mental health settings, does this work? Generally, those two trials that we mentioned, the SMILES trial was the first, and the Healthy Med trial, they're looking at prescribing a Mediterranean style diet. So the SMILES trial emphasized Mediterranean style diet plus a little extra red meat, as there'd been some data that folks who don't eat any red meat and folks who eat a lot of red meat are both at increased risk for depression, but there's kind of a sweet spot. A little red meat, because it's a very nutrient-dense food, can be helpful to mental health or depression risk specifically. Those are the diets they prescribe. They largely mirror what we do. Nutritional psychiatry, as we've worked to develop it, focuses on food categories because I'm from rural Indiana. If you say eat the Mediterranean diet, that's not helpful to a patient, right? Does that mean pizza, pasta, right? Does that mean go get like a lamb gyro? You know, just like we say, another diet with some reasonable data is the Norwegian diet or the Japanese diet. You know, that's like, there's not a sushi place in rural Indiana. I mean, I'm here in Wyoming. There's some sushi for sure, but you want to really apply the principles of these traditional diets to somebody's reality, to an eater's reality. And it's very important to do that because otherwise you have people who, you know, maybe can't afford, I don't know, organic blueberries thinking, gosh, you know, that's the secret to their mental health and why it puts a set of pressures that are artificial on patients and on people, right? That we want to all do the best that we can in our given circumstances to feed our mental health and care for it and take care of our brains. We emphasize food categories that in a lot of the principles of the Mediterranean diet, for example, olive oil is a fat we really emphasize, eating more nuts, beans, and legumes. I don't tend to emphasize whole grains. If you look at both the MIND diet and the Mediterranean diet, there's a lot of emphasis on whole grains and traditional and ancient grains. I haven't found a lot of focus on that in our own work, mainly as what I see over time with patients. We usually are working to help with seafood, with plants, with fermented foods, with diversity and culinary skills, and I put myself in this category, neurotic level conflicts about food. You know, these aren't patients who are struggling with an eating disorder, but they're struggling with, let's say, having a sense of joyfulness, or that food feels like a burden, or that they really just never learned about, I don't know, roasting vegetables. And a lot of the lessons that eaters who really feel good and joyful and nourished and in a harmonious and nurturing relationship with food, you know, kind of, we all have the kind of little meals that got us there. And so that's, I think part of how we see our work.
I'd love to kind of go over those categories. It sounds like olive oil, are you encompassing that into like a healthy fat category, nuts, beans, and legumes in another category, seafood and another protein in another, or is protein? Like, yeah.
So I don't really focus too much on kind of, there's certainly some guides to fats. Like the Happiness Diet has a great chart of all the fats that you eat and what they do. And certainly in my last book, Eat Complete, I definitely go through kind of olive oil. I keep it very simple in my books, to olive oil, usually olive oil, butter, and either coconut oil or avocado oil, to try and, one, just keep the kitchen simple for people. Not that, you know, there are lots of other fats to explore, sesame oil and grapeseed oil, but from a data perspective, the main fat should be olive oil. The food categories, I have a little rhyme, seafood, greens, nuts and beans, and a little dark chocolate. I would make dark chocolate its own special food category. From a science perspective, folks, not just from a marketing perspective, that's science talking. There's a lot of science in the book about dark chocolate, what it does for you, how it's very stimulating food, lots of fiber, lots of iron, lots of magnesium, and a good quality dark chocolate. But those are some of the categories. Certainly, I like to focus also or draw attention to meat, eggs, and dairy consumption, of just understanding how that fits into someone's life and how to help them optimize that. Just saw a patient today, really healthy eater. Actually, in about midway through, I had a little panic moment, like, I've done this like eval here, and this person's really doing well. And then looking at the diet, kind of taking a step back, and noticed, you know, there really weren't any fermented foods. And then there was a lot of seafood during the summer when the person was by the seashore. But then when they got back to work and kind of got in the busy of their life, the busyness of their life, they said, you know, I really miss it. I don't do a good job with seafood when I'm, you know, not during the summer. And began to sort of quickly have these goals around really important food categories, that even though they had a, you know, really high quality, nutrient dense, mainly plant forward diet, there were some missing pieces. It was kind of exciting at the end to see that all of us really, I think, can look at our diet and begin to make some tweaks. I can think about the last 2 weeks of my eating and just things that I did great and things that, you know, I really need to work on.
I love that. No, I think it's a process for everyone. And I think people who follow you would assume like you have it all figured out and that you've been doing this for 15 years and that you eat really clean and probably have great sleep hygiene and an exercise routine. And I love to hear that you're human and you can look
sometimes,
back on.
Sometimes, you know, I've been, so my wife gave me a hug this morning. She's like, you need to exercise today. I was like, I did yesterday. I lifted weights in the morning. It's like a really defensive, like, you know, yeah, irritable husband. Like, I did work out. So I would say in terms of activity, a lot of people are, you know, talking about zone 2 exercise as being so important for our health and longevity. And I think being a country boy and a farm boy, there's some way, like, you know, to me that mainly means like mowing the lawn, you know, doing yard work. You know, there's a way that there's a lot of zone 2 that's built into an active lifestyle. A lot of walking. We do a lot of biking as a family, a lot of hiking. So I do try and be really active. And then sleep hygiene, I've been fortunate and blessed to be a pretty good sleeper. But certainly as I've aged, have had to honor that a little bit more and kind of, you know, I can definitely fall asleep at 9:30 or 10, but I can also stay up until 1. And I function okay both the next day, but you know, it's definitely not the same quality of a day. So I started tracking my sleep about a year ago, and I don't have any affiliation, but I use one of the rings, and I find it to be really, I just find it interesting data. You know, I'm not a big proponent of all the biohacking and the kind of self data, but some of it I think is really helpful. And sleep is at the top of my list of things people should track. Start actually doing that with patients. It's just a way that, like, you know, we can talk about sleep hygiene. We know the tips, but like, hey, let's monitor your sleep. Like, let's understand, are these tips working or not? And if not, what is the next step? Like, how do we get more REM and deep sleep for you so you're cleaning out your brain?
That was one of the biggest takeaways for me from the Oura ring. And I don't know if you're using an Oura, but was that getting to bed between 9:15 and 9:45 got me way more REM sleep.
That was a big takeaway for me. Also, that bedtime, which, like, you can't tell people that bedtime. I mean, I'm a doctor. I tell people sleep hygiene all the time. You say 9 p.m., like, and they're like, in bed? They look at you like, you're crazy. Like, I just told you I'm binging on Netflix till 2 a.m. Like, it's, but when I use the Oura ring, it's sort of easy to, I wouldn't say push back, but say, look, you know, I'm a great sleeper. I thought I was getting 8 hours a night, you know, going to bed around like 11 and getting up at 7. No, yeah, no way. Unless you're in bed by 9:30. You're not getting close to 8 hours of sleep, even if you're a great sleeper. It's really surprising.
Yeah, I know that. And I think that kind of external motivation where you're like, okay, I'm not hearing it from a doctor, but I'm into my own data and I have the app and I'm learning about my own sleep. For me, it's motivating. Let's circle back to your practice. Let's circle back to your new book, which I'm so excited about, because in the book you talk about 12 foods for mental health to beat depression and to beat anxiety. Can we talk about those nutrients specifically? Not, I know we talked about the categories and I love your little jingle.
Sure, yeah.
But the nutrients specifically and what they do and why they are so impactful and what the research says?
Yeah, for sure. Let's talk about some of them and where those nutrients came from. Early as I was thinking about nutritional psychiatry and how to integrate it, I was working with a great psychiatrist, good friend, Dr. Laura LaChance at University of Toronto. And as we were thinking about teaching clinicians to prescribe food and assess food in a mental health setting and how we manualize that, we had this question like, what foods are we going to recommend? And we said, well, you know, we want to recommend the foods with the most nutrients that fight depression and anxiety. And as we thought about that, there wasn't like any lists of those. And so we did a literature review. We found out there were 12 nutrients. A lot of them, you know, players that people know of, vitamin B12, omega-3 fats, iron, magnesium, folate, a few that you know, I would say surprise people, like selenium. And we took those 12 nutrients then, and it's actually, it's an open source paper. It's called Antidepressant Foods. And this is the Antidepressant Food Scale, the AFS. And it created a list of foods. And we did, there are all kinds of different nutrient profiling systems. This was the first one that was ever created specifically for mental health. And we were really excited about that to kind of see like what came out on the other end. So we didn't, a lot of these nutrient profiling systems, they say, okay, these are the nutrients that are good. And they say, oh, there's all stuff that's bad, salt, saturated fat. We didn't say, we said, the only thing we want to know is calories because we're very food neutral. If it's a whole food, if it comes out of the earth, if it's raised on a small farm, I think that is probably for most people healthier than what the processed modern food most people are eating. So anyway, back to the antidepressant food scale. We then listed both animals and plants. We thought this was very important because you always see these like, you know, power foods and it's always a list of plants. And I think that generally is because plants always have fewer calories, right? They don't have as much fat or as much protein. But it's also, I think, unhelpful in the sense that 98% of people eat some meat and oftentimes not a real diverse or particularly nutrient-dense set of meats or animal products. And so we wanted to list those as well. And so what came out was really interesting. Like number one in the plant category was watercress, probably something most of us don't eat much of. But then you start learning like watercress is a major food in Haiti. Like actually I spoke with a Haitian woman, she said, oh, almost every meal in Haiti, we have some watercress, really nutrient dense green. And on the animal side of the top five, three were bivalves, mussels, clams, and oysters. And that was really, in some ways gratifying because I've been keen on the bivalves for a while because they represent nutrient density. If you're looking for a food that doesn't have a lot of calories, has a lot of omega-3 fats, a lot of iron, a lot of B12 in particular, right? Things that are really critical for mental health and brain health. You're talking about an oyster. I mean, those are just incredible when it comes to nutrient density. And so we took those nutrients, we created these lists of foods, and then we kind of saw and understood through some of the literature out there about nutrient profiling systems is what you don't want to do. It's kind of what I'd done with kale, right? Which is like, you don't want to fetishize or create a movement or a profiling system that says, you know, this is about food X. What's really important is to create food categories. And it was a really powerful lesson for me as a clinician where, you know, I mean, I had a lot of fun. I'm being a little silly. Like I was kind of in a kale maniac phase for a number of years. We launched National Kale Day. I wrote a book, 50 Shades of Kale. I made like a gazillion kale chips. I made kale. I would do all these parties where like I'd be the entertainment. I'd mix kale cocktails. I got this vegan friendraiser like hammered once. I mean, just like, like they said, I said, what's my role here? And they're like, we just want you to like help with the fundraising. And I was like, is it okay? I just like mix kale cocktails. And they're like, yeah. It's like all these vegans. So there wasn't a lot of, there was good food there, but you know, it was a lot of, and it was consensual. Everyone knew that there was some alcohol in the drinks, but they raised a lot of money. Get me off on a kale tangent here, Kelly.
Sounds like you were on one for a few years.
It was tough. It's good to be back. Now sunflower sprouts, just sort of is my favorite green, sunflower sprouts, and I'm eating more spinach. I'm just going to say it. And I'm not in any way scared that kale is unhealthy for you. Anyone who's spreading kale rumors, I think like kale are high in oxalates, that's not true, or kale's toxic, that's not true. I think there's a special place in hell for kale haters, but we won't go there. So food categories, what we're talking about. You look at these lists of foods, and we saw on the plant side, leafy greens, rainbow vegetables, particularly like things like peppers and some brain foods, you know, some of our favorites like blueberries and berries, not on our list, right? It doesn't mean that they're not great for your brain. It just means in this way of kind of slicing and dicing up the numbers, you know, other things, beans and nuts really weren't on the list because again, they're higher calorie plant. And then on the animal side, we saw seafood, mostly seafood, some wild meat like elk. And then things, you know, people again stopped eating like organ meats, like liver, you know, very, very nutrient dense. And so we try to take that data and again, learn the lessons of the food categories and expand that into the food categories that, you know, like meat and dairy, a lot of people are consuming, but people aren't consuming like fish roe and wild salmon. They're often just consuming, you know, ground beef and a lot of deli meats. And not that we want to approach this, you know, as mental health professionals from like, you must eliminate all of this, but more of like, like, how do we think about increasing the nutrient density of your diet in a way that really appeals to you and excites you and is actionable? So that's some of how we came up with our food categories, you know, both informed by the evidence around the Mediterranean diet and dietary patterns and what food categories those diets have that American diets are missing, primarily seafood and plants. but then also like the knowledge around that's probably why we clinically have added on just a wonderful set of services with our mental fitness kitchen, which is our cooking school and cooking class, with our coaches who really, I just met with a patient this morning where it's really exciting as we've developed a model by which can really identify where food is appropriate and where it's not, right? People come oftentimes wanting, you know, food to intervene in their mental health in a way that, you know, maybe isn't either appropriate or based in the evidence, but there are a lot of ways where you see, you know, there's a really nice set of skills someone can learn or a set of questions they have. And so we have a great, Emily Berner is actually a really wonderful coach and chef who works with us and our great clinical team, Dr. Anna and Dr. Xiaojie Hu. And then Samantha Elcrief, who kind of runs our clinical service, who's just a wonderful social worker and chef and plant lover and couples therapist. And so we just, I don't know, we have this really nice group in terms of being able to offer everything from meds and med management to lots of deep psychotherapy with a number of different clinicians to offering cooking classes and coaching to really try and, you know, meet people where they are and share this information and this evidence. And, you know, and then the joy that I think our team really finds from food, that all of us are really focused on maximizing joyfulness in our own lives and in the lives of our patients.
Well, a lot of meat there, pun intended. I kind of want to unpack a little bit of it because you mentioned nutrient density a couple of times. For people listening, when you're referring to nutrient density of foods, like, what do you mean by that? And then also, when it comes to looking at these nutrients and making these recommendations to patients, did you see in the data that a deficiency in some of these nutrients caused an increase in anxiety or depression?
That a deficiency in some of the nutrients. Yeah, for sure. There's some data on that, particularly around the B vitamins. Just to answer that question quickly. Yeah. I think also there's significant data now around the microbiome. So being involved with anxiety. So as we seek to increase microbiome diversity, as we seek to increase B vitamin intake, the hope is certainly, and some of the data suggests that those nutrients, some there's a little data on choline. It's just correlational data. Choline comes in eggs and tofu. And Kelly, remind me of your original question.
So you've mentioned nutrient density. Looking at these lists of foods that you've created and these categories to help people. Really, it seems like from my standpoint, looking at what you do, it's like it's filling in their plate and filling in the nutrients where they may be lacking so that they don't have a deficiency, so that they can beat depression and anxiety and that get what their brain needs. So I was just curious, what was the research in regards to nutrient deficiencies and like predisposing you to these, to depression and anxiety?
Let's define nutrient density first. That's a great question. Nutrient density is a really simple math equation, which is you look at all of the nutrients in a food and then you divide it by the number of calories. And so a good example of this is let's look at a Coke, which is about 140 calories. And what nutrients do you get? You know, you get a little sodium in there, but you don't get any, right? You just get sugar and salt and a little phosphorus, I think. So really no nutrients, just calories. And then compare that to a small kale salad, let's say 3 cups of kale. That's a lot of kale, right? I'll chop it up finely. We'll massage it, a little bit of salt, no calories. and let's say like 30, 40 calories of olive oil. So that's about 140 calories there. And some lemon juice, put a little lemon juice in there. Mm-hmm. And that kale salad, oh boy, 3 cups of kale. You're going to have like 1800% of your daily need of vitamin K. You're going to have 600% of your daily need of vitamin A in this cool carotenoid form. So you're getting all this interesting, also phytonutrient benefit of that form. You're going to get like 370-ish% of your daily need of vitamin C. You're going to get a few grams of fiber, a few grams of protein. You're going to get all the phytonutrients. You're going to get the benefits of the olive oil. You're going to get monounsaturated, right? So blah, blah, blah. You're getting all that for 140 calories. So that's nutrient density. That's why these foods, these leafy greens, the bivalves, the grass-fed beef, the egg, right? That's why they end up on, actually there's a list in the HB depression and anxiety of the power players. And they're on that list because they represent these food categories, but they're particularly nutrient dense and accessible. Things like white beans and cashews and anchovies. And a lot of things that over my journey as a brain food focused guy and nutritional psychiatrist, I've learned to incorporate into our family's eating plan in a way that I think really has benefited us in terms of both our health, but also just as a parent feeling like I'm doing the right thing or as best as I can based on the data. You know, stuff like making wild salmon burgers at home, things that like I did not used to do. But the book has a great recipe. It's like one of those things. It's like definitely one of my best moments as a dad when my daughter's like, "Dad, will you make those wild salmon burgers from the book again?" I was like, "Yeah, exactly." I was like, "I'm recording this moment and embedding it into my brain for the rest of my life." So yeah, so I hope that explains some nutrient density. And then your question about nutrient deficiencies, you know, there are two pieces of this that are important. One is what's called the rate of nutrient insufficiency. So this is the percentage of Americans that are not meeting the recommended daily allowance of a key nutrient. And that doesn't necessarily lead to deficiency, but it's maybe an indicator of like the overall quality of our diet. So we look at some of our favorite brain nutrients, like think about the ones on the antidepressant food scale, like zinc. Right. So about half of Americans don't meet the daily need of zinc. And most of us, you know, aren't able to say, "Oh yeah, zinc, I should be eating more pumpkin seeds and oysters." Right. Oftentimes when we think about a nutrient, we get worried we don't have enough, we go get a supplement. And I hope in all of my work, I hope people feel really encouraged, one, to just take good care of your mental health with therapy, with meds, with coaching, with exercise, but also, you know, with food, and to get those nutrients from your food. And that it's not that hard to do that. There's a lot of data that the 12 antidepressant nutrients significantly impact depression. So iron deficiency. Is anybody who's listening has had iron deficiency or anemia or run a little low? Oh, you get depressed. Your brain kind of shuts down. You're unable to make certain neurotransmitters that are key for your brain. It's just you get low energy. So iron deficiency causes depression. B12 deficiency, when you don't have enough B12. So if you're on a fully plant-based diet, you have to supplement B12. Something like almost 70% of British male vegans, a very specific study, are B12 like insufficient to the point that their brain is rapidly shrinking. And I don't mean that to be sensationalistic. It's just a fact about B12. You don't have enough B12, your brain atrophies, you get depressed, you get demented, you get psychotic. It's just like, it's not an uncommon story in an emergency room. Somebody adopted a plant-based diet. They didn't know about B12. Most vegans do. I think so many vegans, vegetarians get pissed because they're like, "I know about B12. But we just acknowledge like a lot don't. So, you know, the bottom line is several B vitamins, folate, B12, others like magnesium deficiency, highly correlated with depression. Magnesium intake in America, generally low. And again, the challenge we have is like more magnesium. What I've tried to do in my own work, because I had a hard time keeping track of it, is just really like that. To me, that's beans and greens. And I just like, I go to town on those. And mineral water, really love getting my minerals from magnesium from mineral water. Good quality mineral water often has a lot of magnesium. So
I love it. I tend to say that a lot when I really like something, but I do. I think what really struck me from your book is that you wrote the book for eaters, you said, and I am such a proponent of that. I hate the do not eat list. I'm all about adding to your plate. How can we add? How can we use the information you're sharing in your book to say, okay, well, where am I missing the mark? Are my kids getting enough seafood? Is our family getting enough beans? Are we having, I'm going to add the dark chocolate in. Are we having enough dark chocolate?
Right. I mean,
The greens, you know, like I, and if people listening are here listening, they know I'm protein, fat, fiber, and greens. Like, do you have that on your plate? Great. Okay. I don't care if you're keto or vegan or carnivore.
That's what you want to see there. Like, that's what the body runs on. And I think so often, you know, when people see that and they think greens, they think like salad. And I found like one of the big shifts we've had is helping people like cook their greens and add greens into soups and stews. And I had a patient the other day was saying like, oh, you know, I was really struggling. Then I discovered soup and described this great soup where she'd get like some bone broth from a local place. And then she'd add in veggies and beans. And I just thought like, that is such a great, simple, easy kind of single person or student friendly way to just, again, get a lot of good, simple nutrition on a good budget that really, you know, again, feeds the microbiome and feeds the brain. I feel we'd be remiss. We haven't talked about omega-3 fats. That's something most Americans don't eat. The United States doesn't even have a recommended daily allowance of long-chain omega-3 fats. See, people are confused. They confuse plant-based omega-3 fats like flaxseed with the animal-based, the longer-chained EPA and DHA. So I try to be very specific in my work. I'm talking about long-chain omega-3 fats. You can get it from an algal supplement in terms of DHA, but my general recommendation is from fish, particularly small fish and oily fish. I know there's so many questions about mercury and microplastics. You avoid those by getting the smaller fish like anchovies, sardines, or things like wild salmon. And omega-3 fats are just one of those really interesting and important aspects of nutritional psychiatry and mental health for just, I find a lot of people not taking those in their diet in a way that, again, because mostly it's seafood where you find them.
Right. And I think that's something, depending on where you grew up and access to seafood, how you were, like I said, how you were raised, that seafood might not be something that people are serving up all the time to their family. That's a key supplement that I give to my children, my husband, and that I take myself kind of as insurance. I'm very minimalist when it comes to supplements, but that's just because rounding that out for me, for them, when they maybe aren't willing to eat it all the time is important to me because of that research. I love that you touched on the fact that short chain is not the same as long chain. I think that confusion still is out there because companies are allowed to throw omega-3 fats on the side of flax oil or, you know, whatever.
Well, you know, it does get converted. And if you're totally plant-based, more of that is probably better than not eating it. You know, I'm not, it's right. Just we want to, you know, humans don't convert a lot, and it's an essential fatty acid for a reason. It's essential because you need to eat it. And if you don't have as good of outcomes. I mean, there's something, I think it's six times there's a six time increased risk of postpartum depression in women who don't consume seafood or have higher levels of DHA prior to childbirth. And so, you know, there's just some things that really feel actionable in terms of protecting our mental health and probably my favorite part of nutritional psychiatry, Kelly, is how it allows us to get more into a stance of prevention and engagement, right? That you and I are talking about mental health and ways to improve our mental health and take care of our brains, but you don't have to be my patient, right? You don't have to take a medication. You don't have to go into therapy and talk about like hard stuff. You just have to think about what your neurons need. And the other thing we haven't talked about besides like all these great nutrients is just what they then do. And it's a really important shift for people. It's not just about putting fuel in. It's about creating a dynamic process by which your brain is in grow mode. That if you think about your brain not as a static organism, right? You get all these cells and then most of them like fade and die and then you're demented and then you die. But to think of it instead of this dynamic organism that's growing as a dynamic part of you, and that you really have a significant impact on the rate and amount of brain growth going on upstairs. You know, and I find that to be very hopeful. Like this is, I find the most hopeful concept in neuroscience that I, you know, when I'm struggling with, I don't know, remembering a name or, you know, I just move time zones and like the calendaring when I'm looking and it's like, okay, they're in mountain time, but I'm scheduling them in East Coast time, but I'm in Central. It's like, I have some sense and I see my brain start to get that, right? It takes a little bit, start to learn and it gives me hope. I think it should give anybody with symptoms hope, right? That if you think about it not as, oh, you have depression because, you know, you're an awful person or guilty or have bad genes, but that you maybe have been engaged in some things that are hampering your brain growth and your brain repair. So this is modulated through a molecule I talk a lot about in the book, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF. It's just one of those things that, you know, food influences. It's kind of this one of those levers. So along with helping you build a better brain with better nutrients, I'm also hoping in this kind of almost meta process, right, to coax your brain through the signals that your body gets from food into more of a grow mode.
So how do we increase BDNF in the brain through food?
Well, there are a couple of ways. You know, the science of it, there's only one study about BDNF blood levels in food that I've been able to find. It relates to nuts. It was a study done in Spain where they augmented individuals with olive oil and with nuts. And it was a Mediterranean diet, Mediterranean country, Spain. So there's already a lot of olive oil consumption. And the individuals who got nuts, one of the findings is they had a 78% decreased risk of having severely low BDNF levels. And so BDNF levels in the blood is not like a perfect biomarker, but just striking. And then the other data comes more from kind of bench science, as we call it, where you're looking at how different genes in our body get turned on. And so you look at different factors in food that turn on the production of BDNF. And so far, it looks like there are about six of them. Some nutrients certainly do that. DHA, one of the omega-3 fats, seems to do that. Some of the anthocyanins from berries. So iron, zinc certainly does that. Magnesium does that. So you know, this handful of nutrients, again, which are kind of the nutrients we've been talking about throughout this podcast. And they're the nutrients that if you eat these power players and think about feeding your brain and your mental health with these core foundational foods, you get a lot of. And I would say that's my hope really with the book and with our work is, especially as people are struggling so much with a resistant depression, right? That we give folks a feeling they have a hand on the lever. They can really move things forward for themselves and their mental health with their nutrition.
Definitely. And in your book, you also talk about the connection between the brain and the gut and how that influences brain health. Can we dive into that a little bit and some of your findings?
For sure, Kelly, we have to dive into that, right? It's like 2021, we have to say the word microbiome or they'll like, yeah. Wellness or they're overlords like, will like be like, you guys didn't say microbiome, you're out.
Did they even tape the podcast?
Right, exactly. So microbiome is most people know, but maybe, and I still meet folks who really haven't heard of it. This is thinking about all the bacteria that live in your colon mostly. And, you know, and that's weird, right? Because we think bacteria is gross, like our house is full of antibiotics and antibacterials, and we want to like kill the bacteria. So it's a strange pivot for us all to make that actually, no, you want to foster a really healthy, diverse group of bacteria in your gut is one of the foundations of your health. And you do that in two ways, the little two-step dance. You eat fermented foods and you eat more plants. And that does it. Without fermented foods, not so clear you can do it. And a lot is like a daily fermented food things. And without plants, you know, you're just putting the bugs down there and then you're starving them. So fermented food have live bacteria in them, like lactobacillus mainly. And you want to think about those as, you know, they're kind of like planting seeds. And then the way you feed those or nourish those seeds, nourish those healthy bacteria is by feeding them a diverse set of plant fibers. But, you know, ones I love for my microbiome, I eat a lot of leeks, a lot of yellow onions are probably daily consumption in my house, good amount of garlic in my house, a lot of cabbage and other kind of rough leafy greens, but a lot of kind of sauteed and roasted cabbages, cauliflowers. Those are kind of all, and again, trying to have a diverse set of fibers where I'm not eating my broccoli every single day, although I eat a lot of broccoli, but I'm roasting it, which allows more digestion of the fibers by the bugs and more tolerability and less gas. And then I'm eating it regularly. So the microbiome is involved in energy balance. There's a lot of data that some of our obesity and diabetes epidemic is caused by what's called dysbiosis, that, you know, there's just what's then living in the gut are bugs that thrive on the kind of leftovers of fast food, a lot of sugars, a lot of saturated fats, a lot of salts. And that's just a different set of bacteria. I also think it's a little bit like a zoo. Right. If you had a zoo and you only fed it, if you had like the carnivore zoo, like you're only going to have lions, right? It's like, you're not like, there's not going to be any like elephants in your zoo, right? But if you're going to have like, you know, a diverse set of animals in your zoo, you're going to have a lot of different foods that you're bringing in. And you should think about your plant consumption and your fermented food consumption like that. I just saw a patient this morning that I said, who really healthy, great eater, but you know, sort of spot like no fermented foods, and ask her a little bit more about that. And she said, you know, she tries, like, she has some yogurt, occasionally buy some sauerkraut and kimchi, but doesn't really have a lot of ways to use it. One of those things, that a place we find a lot of patients where, you know, this is like pressure. You should be doing this. You should be doing that. You should. And that's not kind of, how I put it, the intervention isn't delivered with actionable steps often. And often people are confused. And so it's where we really like to work with patients to kind of think about, all right, like I said, it's, you know, great goal would be to use the whole jar of kimchi and to think about two or three really good go-to recipes that really fill you up with joyfulness, but also like feed your microbiome with all this great fiber and good bugs.
I love that you stress joyfulness around eating. It seems like your whole practice does, and using food to obviously beat depression and anxiety, but really to like enjoy it and take ownership over what you're making in your kitchen, and you're helping people do that with actionable steps. What are some of your favorite ways to get people cooking in the kitchen, or what recommendations do you have if someone's tuning in and they can make two meals by heart, but they're like having a hard time getting in their kitchen, and it feels like overwhelming to have this long list of things to do. Where do we start?
Start with oven roasted vegetables. If that's not a big part of your house, it's really the easiest thing. I think also, you know, in chapter 6 of the book, Eat or Heal Thyself, I have this request that everybody take a step back, because I feel like we're in this like Vitamix blender of like vegan carnivore wars and like, you know, lectin oxalate toxin and just like, blah, 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 just a lot of, blah. I don't want to say a lot of bullshit, because I think that there are some important issues in there, but a lot of fear mongering.
Oh yeah.
And so what's then gotten missed, our health has gotten messed up because we don't roast vegetables and eat simple foods at home. Our health has gotten messed up because we're eating a lot of processed food. Our mental health is in part getting messed up because we don't have a healthy metabolism, and we're not feeding our brains, and we're not feeding our mental health. That's kind of gotten out of focus. And I think the goal of our work is to really create more joyfulness. I don't find there's a lot of joyfulness in the food and the wellness movement these days. I find there's a lot of empty gratitude, and I find there's a lot of love and joyfulness too. But I just think that there needs to be a recollection that people are human, that we need to respect each other and our different values, that many different ways are successful in feeding the human brain and feeding our mental health. But there are some really important specifics that nutritional psychiatry elucidates and can help people with.
I love that. It's going back to the basics.
I think some of it is certainly going back to the basics. I mean, you think, you know, like a lot of these foundational traditional foods, you know, are really, they're important. It's funny, you know, we had this phrase like eat what grandma ate, but I don't think you can say that anymore. Like grandpa was eating in like the 50s and 60s in America, like do not eat like grandma ate. Like, you know, and I'm not also so sure, you know, it's interesting right now. It's the first time in human history we've said, let's go backwards. And it's a really interesting moment for us to be thinking, you know, there's, as we think about more evolutionarily informed diets, how human nutritional needs may be changing in subtle ways that we're going to start understanding more about. It's really that there may be dietary needs that begin to evolve that we have that, you know, we didn't exactly have in the past. So it's a very interesting time to be allowed to be an eater. But yes, Kelly, I do think there's a way that simplifying things is important, and dismissing fear is important. That motivation should not simply come from fear. It's an important motivator for all of us. You'll get sick, and you will get more challenges in your mental health if you don't nourish yourself properly. That's just a factual statement. However, like the bigger opportunity is that you have a really fascinating creative brain. You have an immense capacity for human love. Each brain does. You have an immense capacity to change the world in all kinds of wonderful small ways around you. And maybe in some really big and amazing ways, who knows? The size of it doesn't actually matter very much to me. It's more that when people really engage joyfully, when people are really achieving the upper echelon of mental fitness and mental health, that there is a sense of vibrancy and love that really ripples for all of us. And I think all of us aspiring to have more of that, to be more in that stance, is good for us, good for our communities, good for the planet. So I hope this work and this information, and I hope everybody listening, you know, has gotten something of that, some little tip. Maybe it's the anchovies, maybe it's the mantra of brain growth, maybe it's some encouragement to come to the Mental Fitness Kitchen and learn some of our tricks and tips. But I hope mostly it's empowerment to really take care of your mental health and encouragement to do that.
It absolutely is. I feel inspired today. Your force field and energy aura is positive, and you're rippling across this podcast. People are following you on social media. They feel that your positivity resonates with people. And I think that's the light in the wellness space that we need, especially. We don't need to be fearful of our spinach or our kale. We need to get excited to learn how to roast some veggies and add some greens when we can.
Salmon here and there, some anchovies.
Why not? I'm going to try those salmon burgers with my boys.
Try the salmon burgers. See if your kids like them. The honey soy did a little better with our kids, and they like that kind of flavor profile, but I like the dilly ones. Although I messed up. I put the yogurt in for the first time. Don't do that. It's for the sauce. It's not for the mix. The other recipe in the book that we really like that was new to our family is dashi. If you like ramen or udon or those sort of noodle dishes, the base is dashi. It's a broth that's made of fermented, smoked, dried tuna and kombu seaweed and some soy sauce or fermented Bragg's amino acids or something like that. Really makes this amazing, really kind of smoky, delicious, very soothing, calming, feels gut healing broth. So that's in the book as well. And a great one where you can dress it up with your own, whatever noodles, you know, maybe rice noodles, or maybe you want to skip the noodles, drop in a hard boiled egg and a little bit of wild salmon in there. And it just really makes a delicious soup bowl. So, but I'm excited you feel inspired, Kelly, and I want to hear where that leads you and your family.
Definitely. Well, I'm gonna make some of these recipes and tag you before we go, because we talked about it before we jumped on the podcast. You know that I love blood sugar, and I wanted to know, was there anything in your research that you uncovered in regards to how blood sugar impacts the way that we feel?
For sure. And there's both first my clinical experience when you sit as a physician with people who are their blood sugars, you know, high, 150, 160. I know people often feel symptoms of that. Now, for those of us and for folks who are eating a reasonably regulated diet of mostly whole foods, you know, you grab that candy bar, have that ice cream, you feel a little thump in your chest. And then certainly low blood sugar, you know, that there's a, you know, that cliche of kind of hangry, right? But that's a real moment for all of us actually to work on mindfulness, is when there's a, you know, when we're well fed, but we're hungry. You know, I find that I'll sometimes get that late afternoon if I haven't eaten a proper breakfast, of really feeling like I am going to starve, and to really kind of settle down. I'm like, you're not like you're going to go hydrate and eat well. You have food security. But yeah, blood sugar has a significant effect, I would say, on a mood and anxiety. I think the other way that I see sugar affecting mood a lot is through alcohol and people just consuming a lot of alcohol and alcohol sugars. That's obviously having a really negative impact on mood, but also negative impact on kind of mood and eating the next day, of just, you know, a lot of kind of hangover food, right? And kind of greasy food. And so those are some of the ways that I think, blood sugar regulation. I think there also, as we're understanding, you know, there's a lot of controversy in continuous glucose monitoring, but I think increasingly we're understanding that there's just a group of patients that we haven't done a great job taking care of, that blood sugar really has lived in the realm of type 2 diabetes, and that blood sugar dysregulation is just revolved around diabetes. You know, super important illness and very important to focus on. I don't mean to dismiss that in any way, but the idea that there are other disorders or other conditions, let's say, or just other patterns of how people respond to carbohydrates. You know, I think we're learning more about that than we've ever known, and are going to learn more about that and how to kind of most appropriately use continuous glucose monitoring to help people as they're having struggle. We had a patient who, you know, was really not, you know, seemingly healthy, really struggling, did a continuous glucose monitoring, was dropping into like the 45, 50, like really low blood sugar in the middle of the night, and did some dietary adjustments and was really able to eliminate that. And the kind of thing that, you know, in the past would have really gotten missed or thought of differently, right? So I would say it's an exciting new era in terms of thinking about blood sugar. And then also the other, besides just the daily level, the other part is a psychiatrist and a clinician in mental health. I really like to check hemoglobin A1Cs, which is your, it's kind of an approximation how glycated your hemoglobin is. So you just think about your hemoglobin as this like big, I don't know, protein blob floating around in your blood, and how much sugar is in your bloodstream is going to kind of determine how candy coated it is. And that over time, as it floats there, if you got a lot of blood sugar, it's going to be real candy coated, like peppermint candy, right? And if your blood sugars are regulated over 3 months, that hemoglobin, it's not going to have a bunch of glycation or sugar on it. And so that's a nice way to get a sense of somebody's long-term blood sugar regulation, and something that I do think is, you know, not a direct correlate or marker of mental health, but something that really, you know, certainly as blood sugar dysregulation like diabetes, I mean, there's a doubling the risk of depression for diabetes and obesity. So super relevant.
Wow. I loved your analogy for A1C. That's the best way I've ever heard it put. Now I know our listeners know what that marker means. So thank you for sharing that. And thank you for spending so much time with me today. Nutritional psychiatry, I think, is the holistic way of treating mental health diagnoses, because you're looking at the whole body. These recommendations that you're making, but for people to learn how to roast veggies, I mean, that's rippling into their life, their kids' lives, their roommates' lives. It's real change that you're doing, and I appreciate it so much.
Thank you so much, Kelly. I really appreciate your help spreading the word and helping educate people about the importance of nutrition and blood sugar regulation and our friend fiber and plants. And I really wish you and your young family the very best. I hope all this information helps you guys feed two wonderful growing young brains in your house. It's a lot of, part of what inspired me to do nutritional psychiatry is just, it's a lot of responsibility. And it's one of those things that it's easy to make jokes. We all make jokes about, you know, pizza and ice cream and what kind of parent you're going to be and how much sugar. But, you know, as a parent, it's a lot of responsibility where you're sitting with this person's experience, not wanting them to, you know, miss out and not try stuff, but also, you know, a lot of responsibility for the nutrition that relates to their mental health and their brain development. And it's, I'm really glad that you're spreading the word about it and thinking about it yourself. And I look forward to continuing the conversation someday.
Yeah. Well, before we leave now, I have to know one last thing. What boundaries have you set with your kids when it comes to the way that they eat and how you support them to not miss out, but also ensure that their brain has everything that it needs to thrive?
Yeah, I try and be a good dad by not being a jerk. That I think it's a lot of pressure having a father who's a physician and like a brain food guy and kale advocate. So I really try to be gentle with my kids around food. I certainly am pretty firm about some things, and some of my boundaries are around trying seafood and eating protein and meats. We definitely have a kind of veggie first. We'll often like serve, you know, the veggies our kids like, which for our kids, my son really loves red peppers and orange peppers chopped up in olive oil and lemon juice, but he does not like any cooked peppers. Everybody loves cooked broccoli in our house and oven roasted vegetables. So we eat a lot of those. I think I try to be very clear about circumstance, not stress people out. So if we're on a road trip and we're hungry, we'll eat fast food. I think it's important to be aware of that stuff, actually. You know, it's kind of like a long time ago, they got rid of all the drug reps in hospitals. Yeah. And like, I applauded that. I thought it was great. But there's also part of the training that I thought was really important of when you're influenced by big pharma and what that feels like, how that feels kind of icky, how it feels exciting, how it gets in there under your skin and suddenly you're prescribing this medicine that you just learned about at that drug launch. And so there's something so disturbing about that, that when you take it away, you know, So I think it's important to, you know, I'll eat a fast food hamburger and sit with how delicious and how fast it goes down and then sit with how kind of sick I feel 20 minutes later. So the other food boundaries probably revolve around like food dyes, breakfast cereals. I wouldn't say they're firm rules. It's just like stuff that we just never buy. Like you're never going to find a can of soda in my house. Like, you know, you might find some kombucha, which some people would argue it's a sugary fizzy drink, but you know, it serves a purpose and that's kind of our soda. You'll certainly find kitty cocktails, you know, which are like grape juice and seltzer, but I'd really try not to have soda or juice in our home. I really try not to have a lot of, I don't know, kind of garbage snacks, you know, chips and crackers. And I, at the same time, I try to have like, you know, a nice store of gelatos and ice cream. I don't want people to think my kids are getting deprived of, you know, having a childhood and enjoying food. But those are some of the, I guess, tenets that we, and then a lot of, I would say the number one thing that I really love about our family and food is just, we just eat together. Like pretty much every dinner, every breakfast, we sit down, we eat the same thing, real simple oatmeal. Mom and dad have coffee, a lot of berries and nuts. We sit down, you know, we have probably beans and rice, a bunch of like sauteed onions and peppers once a week. So that part I really like.
It's the most important thing, exposure for your kids to see that. That's what the research tells us. It's just like powerful.
I also think it's important as a parent to be kind to yourself, like not to be a jerk to yourself. Like these aren't, you know, always like idyllic meals. Sometimes like I'm a jerk. Sometimes, you know, I'm hungry. Sometimes like the kids don't eat it. You know, I think there's a, it's the other thing that I really understood about kids is the way that palate develops, like how the kids will devour the kale chips I make, but they won't eat sauteed kale, but one will eat a kale Caesar salad. And you know, that there's a really, you know, kind of adds to the challenge and creativity of being a parent, right? Kind of like, how can I solve this puzzle by, they're eating foods that they like, they're developing their palate, they're getting a positive message, but you know, they're also, they themselves having some fun. And let's say that is, we include them in the kitchen a lot. You'll see this on, I don't know, my Instagram, and it's sort of some of my favorite shots where it's like, you know, I got my two little sous chefs and they're like chopping the bejesus out of a bunch of vegetables and, you know, making a smoothie. It's really that's one of, as a parent, those are my, you know, favorite times when they want to make something or cook together. So.
Me too. Dr. Drew, this was amazing. I could talk to you all day. Thank you so much. Congratulations on your new book, Eat to Beat Depression and Anxiety. I will put all these links to all of your previous books and your Instagram and everything in the show notes. But if people are listening in their car and driving along, where can they follow you online?
So thanks, Kelly, for the conversation. Everyone, you can follow me. I'm Drew Ramsey, MD on Instagram and Facebook. My website is drewramseymd.com. That's where you can access our great team of clinicians, but also we have a bunch of free downloads around brain health and brain food just to help you in your kitchen. And I hope some helpful content in terms of just thinking about nutritional psychiatry and mental health. And I look forward to seeing you on social. And also we have a new great newsletter, Friday Feels, comes out every Friday. We try and give you some great new information that's coming out about food and mental health in general, and also a recipe. And that's where people can also learn about the Mental Fitness Kitchen. I think that's our best. I really love the Mental Fit. Besides our clinicians who are amazing, our Mental Fitness Kitchen is really, I did the cooking class last time. It's awesome. We made this Mediterranean style garbanzo bean salad. When we had we made a beet kefir like chilled soup. It was like, so like I drank it and I was like, this is like the healthiest thing I've ever put in my body. And then we made this kubu sake, which is this, I think it's Persian inspired. It's like 6 cups of greens in a frittata. And it's like so much greens, you're like, this is not going to work. And then it cooks down, you put in the eggs and it's like, it's so good. So that's what we made last time. So anyway, thank you everybody for listening. I hope this helps inspire you. It's a really, really challenging time when we're recording this in 2021. And so it's really important you take care of your mental health. If your mental health is good, it's really important you pass that on and reach out to somebody that you love close to you and take care of their mental health a little bit. And I think that's how we get through all this. And I wish you all the very best. And Kelly, thank you so much for a great conversation.
It was awesome. Thank you, Dr. Drew.
Thank you for listening to Be Well by Kelly. Please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Learn more at BeWellByKelly.com and follow me on Instagram at BeWellByKelly. I would love if you picked up my books, Body Love and Body Love Every Day. They're sold on Amazon and at all major booksellers.